offer my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, coming to you live from our studios at Prashanthi Nilayam. And this is a show where we go through the Bhagavad Gita verse by verse, try to understand the import of each verse in the backdrop of Swami's message. Of course, the Gita Vahini is a text that we very often fall back upon, and most of our understanding is drawn from that. And of course, the many, many discourses that Swami has graced us with over the years. We are still in the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, and as I've mentioned many times before, the second chapter itself is more or less like a summary of the entire Gita, and the chapters which come hereafter are explanations of the many concepts which Krishna touches upon in the second chapter. We are in the fag end of the second chapter. I think maybe a couple of weeks more we should be done with the second chapter. And in the second chapter, the portion that we are going through is the qualities of a sthita prajna. As we saw a few weeks ago, Arjuna raises this question to Krishna, who is a sthita prajna? Can you describe him to me? Can you tell me how he walks, how he carries himself, how he talks? And of course, we spoke about how the import of asking this question was not to know how he would carry himself, but to understand the inner working of a sthita prajna, and that is what Krishna answers to. Krishna doesn't give him a description of his habits and demeanor, but he goes on to give him a description of his inner nature, and that is where we are still. Probably as always, we'll begin with a short summary of what we covered last week, because the verses that we are going to go through this week are very much connected. In fact, I could have even played the verse that we're going to start with today and the verse we completed with last week together, because it's a continuation. Nevertheless, I'll give you a short summary, and maybe that'll give us enough idea to carry on with the verses for this week. We covered verses 57, 58, and 59 last week. As I said, these were also part of the description of sthita prajna. In verse number 57, Krishna says that he who is not attached to any outcome at any time, be it an auspicious outcome and an inauspicious outcome, a pleasant or an unpleasant outcome, one who does not look forward to anything nor does he abhor anything, such a person has wisdom that is firmly established. That's what Krishna says in verse number 57. And more or less, this is the description or the definition of sthita prajna that Krishna uses. But of course, there were some very beautiful words that Krishna uses in this particular verse. And last week, we went into a bit of detail about that, of the idea of attachment, the idea of pain and empathy. How to be compassionate but not be attached is one of the discussions that we went through last week. Well, if you missed it, then you just have to go and look for the file of last week and listen to it. Verse number 58 presents a very beautiful simile of a tortoise, and Krishna says that one who can withdraw his senses from the sense objects, like a tortoise that withdraws its limbs within its shell, will have a steady wisdom. We again discussed in detail what this actually means. Does it suggest that we should completely withdraw our senses? The question came, if the senses are meant to be withdrawn away from all the sense objects, why were the senses given at all? Well, we went a little more in detail into the simile itself. When does a tortoise withdraw its limbs into itself? It is when it is endangered, right? In the similar manner, we are supposed to withdraw the senses when the purpose of life that we are trying to pursue is endangered, or our discrimination is endangered, right? So we went into a little bit of discussion on that. But in the next verse, Krishna says that when the senses are not fed or allowed to go after the sense objects, they do certainly behave themselves or don't go astray, but the longing or the taste for the sense objects does not necessarily vanish, right? For the longing to go away one must have had the vision of the Supreme, right? It is only then even the rasa or the taste for such things melts away, right? That's what Krishna said in the last verse that we went through, which is the 59th verse. As I said, the next verse that we are going to be covering today, the verse number 60, is a continuation of that same thought. Probably I'll give you a few reminders that we discussed last week, because that's important to go through the verses that we're going to go through. When we say senses, it is not the ear, the eyes, the nose, because these are just the sense organs. It is the reference that we are making to the jnanendriyas, right? The senses with the mind that qualifies what the senses see. The mind that says that this sight is good or this smell is inviting and so on. So whenever we say senses, whenever we speak about controlling the senses, we are referring to the jnanendriyas, which is the sense organ backed by the mind that qualifies what the senses perceive. That is one reminder that I thought we'll leave. So the next verse will be a continuation. The previous verse, Krishna said that even the people, even those that are trying to withdraw themselves by means of starving the senses of the sense objects, right? We discussed a beautiful analogy that Swami would give of a mother and child walking into the market, and the child runs after everything that it sees, but the mother does not entertain the child, does not indulge the child. She keeps walking, and eventually the child, you know, realizes that there's no point in crying and making a scene and joins the mother. And Swami would say, similarly, the mind and the senses crave after everything that it sees. But if the discrimination is right, and if you can keep walking and ignore all of these signs that are coming from the senses, eventually the senses will fall in line. Verse number 59, Krishna says that even though the senses that are starved in this manner will behave themselves, the craving or the taste for sense objects does not necessarily vanish, and it vanishes only when there is a vision of the Supreme. So from there, verse number 60 is going to be a continuation, as always. I have it very beautifully and clearly rendered by Brother Shyam. I'll play out the verse. We'll listen to it. I'll give you a short meaning of that verse after that, and then we'll discuss that in detail.
Yatato hyapi kaunteya purushasya vipaschitaha indriyani pramathini haranti prasabham manaha.
For, O son of Kunti, the turbulent organs violently snatch away the mind of an intelligent person, even while he is striving diligently. Krishna continues that explanation from the last verse here by emphasizing that to get over cravings, one has to do more than merely abstinence. Because that was what was referred to in the previous verse. There's a very famous and humorous quip which is often quoted. It is so easy to quit drinking. I've done it so many times, right? That's something which a lot of addicts would say. Because it is not merely about separating the sense organ from the objects of the senses, the vishayas and the indriyas. That alone will not help. Though that is a starting point, that is a ground which is useful, and that is, it's like a preparatory field. And that is why Swami even emphasizes on the ceiling on desires to a great extent. But that alone will not help, and that is what is emphasized in this verse. It has to be coupled with a process that will completely sublimate the taste itself. And that is the state of sthita prajna, and that should be the goal of those of us who are trying to reach that state. So what is it that has to be coupled? Of course, discrimination is one of them. We've been speaking about that in the past couple of weeks. That is, consciously to wonder if one certainly needs to follow a message that is coming through the senses, right? The food is in front of me. It is delicious, but can I afford to eat it? I'm driving by a road and see a poster for an ad for a product. Swami would say, pause and ask yourself, do I really need it, instead of just being attracted by it and saying that, oh, I have to go and get that one, right? So that constant discriminative process of seeing that, do I really need this? Can I afford this? What will happen if I indulge in this? So the abstinence must be backed with this sort of discrimination. But even this will not be enough. That is what Krishna is explaining in this particular verse. Abstinence alone will not work. Abstinence plus discrimination is good, but abstinence plus discrimination also is not good enough. He says, Kaunteya, O son of Kunti, yatataha hi api purushasya. Even for the person, as I said, the reference is still to the person that was being referred to in the previous verse. Here Krishna is making a reference to those that are making the effort to control oneself. Yatataha hi api purushasya. Vipaschitaha, the one who is seeing clearly through one's discrimination. Indriyani pramathini, the tumultuous sense organs. Indriyani are the sense organs. Pramathini, those that are agitated, and the sense organs are agitated when they see something and start craving for it, right? So an agitated sense organ, indriyani pramathini, haranti prasabham manaha, forcefully takes away the mind. So he's saying even when you're talking about a person who is having enormous amount of self-control, even when you're talking about somebody who is a vipaschitaha, who is able to see clearly, who is discriminating clearly, even for such a person, haranti prasabham manaha, the mind can be stolen away by indriyani pramathini, by the mind, by the senses which have been agitated. I think this is a very, very important verse, especially for all of us who are, I'm sure, like me, all of you are also struggling in the sadhana. When I was doing the answering booth, or even when we interact with some devotees, especially youngsters, we are often asked this question that, you know, we are very sincere in our sadhana, but then slowly the mind loses its balance, all kinds of thoughts start coming. And, you know, when the mind loses its purity in that manner, that will lead to the springing up of self-esteem in one's, low self-esteem in oneself. In fact, when I was answering a very similar question on the answering booth of going astray on the spiritual path, I remember mentioning this. We usually imagine that all of those people whom we consider as saints and saintly people are perfect people, be it from our scriptures, be it from the epics, or be it even from those around us in the Sai circle, if I could put it that way. We imagine that they're all very, very perfect. They do not have ups and downs. Their mind never, you know, goes up and down. And in contrast with the imagination that we have of those people, when we look at the flaws in our own mind, I think that is when we tend to look down upon ourselves, or we get agitated about ourselves, or we lose hope about ourselves, right? But the fact is, it is not so. Not all those people who are portrayed in that manner. Of course, it is done so for a good reason, because when we are given such ideal images in front of us, we strive for that, right? But when we start losing hope when we are looking at the perfection of people like that, I think that becomes a very, very dangerous thing. So the truth is what Krishna is saying here. Even those who are putting efforts to develop self-control, vipaschitaha, those who are wise, the literal translation of that word vipaschitaha means those who can see clearly. And who can see clearly? Those who are able to discriminate clearly. Even such people have their minds forcefully stolen away when the senses are stirred. All that this suggests is this endeavor has to be constant and relentless. We cannot say, you know what, I controlled my mind for a few years, I lived a very simple life, now nothing can touch me. This can never be the attitude. In fact, consider this, even when we are talking about physical fitness, isn't it so clear that we have to be leading an active life and keep exercising regularly to maintain that fitness in the body? So, you know, when they talk about fitness and having a fit lifestyle, they always talk of it as making fitness a habit, of making fitness a lifestyle. That is one of the best ways to stay fit. So this, even when you're talking about the body, we are talking of effort that has to be constant and relentless, right? Similarly, to keep the mind under control, it must become a regular exercise. It must become a habit. And of course, later Krishna will repeat and explain the importance of this kind of habit leading to, practice leading to habit. We'll come to that because that's again a very, very important verse. And I think it comes somewhere right in the middle of the Bhagavad Gita, so let's not worry about that right now. But sometimes it helps just to be aware that even the most austere mind can be attacked by Indriyani Pramathini, the senses which have been agitated or which have been stimulated. So to acknowledge this fact is very, very helpful. It will keep us vigilant and it will also keep us hopeful. I recall a very beautiful incident which one of Swami's students was once narrating, and this student, even before he joined Swami's college, had the habit of meditating. So when he joined Swami's college, he found that the place was so perfect for his spiritual sadhana. He used to sit and meditate and effortlessly used to go into a very beautiful state of meditation. And, you know, he thought that, you know, things couldn't get any better. It was absolutely like living a dream. But this lasted for a few months. And within, I think, 3 or 4 months, he found that suddenly his mind started becoming so agitated. All kinds of thoughts started flooding his mind. He lost his tranquility. He could not meditate. So he thought, just as I said, that he is such a sinner that sitting before Swami, all these kind of thoughts are coming to him, and that led to enormous amount of guilt. He didn't know what to do. So he finally made bold and wrote a letter to Swami. He said, Swami, all these kind of thoughts are coming and I'm not able to meditate and all that. And literally pouring out all his tears into that letter, he sent it to Swami. And promptly Swami sent word that asked this boy to sit in front that evening. So this boy now got worried because he thought, now I have this very good image in hostel. People think that here is a very, you know, goody-goody boy. He's a very saintly boy. He does morning meditation and all of these things. And if in front of all his friends and classmates and seniors and juniors, if Swami were to come and start discussing the letter that he had written, he thought, you know, what would happen to my image? All of these people will think, hey, you pretend to be such a saintly chap. But, I mean, do you have these kind of thoughts? Because he was thinking that it was a very, very odd thing that he was going through. So Swami calls him for an interview inside. So first of all, he's happy that it's not going to happen in the open. And in the interview, Swami, very casually tells him, what happened? What is your problem? So again, he explains whatever he had written in the letter. Then Swami asked him a very, very beautiful question. Swami said, do you think it is for no reason that the great yogis have been practicing meditation for hundreds of years in the Himalayas? If to control the mind was so simple, why would these people who are so dedicated to sadhana spend so many hundreds of years in meditation? Do you think you can sit for a few minutes a day for 3 months and achieve that kind of stillness of mind? Swami said it is not so easy. That is why it's so difficult, and that's why the practice needs to be lifelong. And then Swami very, very lovingly explained to him, Sira, this is the nature of the mind. The mind is such, the mind will be going out. Don't worry about it. You only have to try not to follow the mind. Try not to follow the mind with your actions. You only ensure that. Don't worry about what the mind thinks. Of course, there is a further explanation that Swami gives. I'm not going to go into that because I feel that that might come handy in a later point where it might be more appropriate. We'll talk about it when it comes there. But this is one part of the explanation which I thought is very, very important, which Swami said. First of all, acknowledge that what we are trying to do is difficult. Secondly, as Krishna explained here, even for that person who is completely in control of oneself, for the person who has very good discrimination, when the senses are agitated, the mind is disturbed. That's a standard thing. Don't overreact when that happens. So one thing is it will keep you ready, right? When you know that you're living in an area where there are a lot of thieves, you become more vigilant, right? Similarly, when you know that your mind can be stolen away by the sense objects, you just become more vigilant. you start watching your mind more carefully, right? So that is why to start with, it is important to keep in mind that as long as the mind is, it will have rasa or taste or what the senses bring. And I always think of this analogy. Imagine that, let's say there is a diabetic patient and that person has decided not to take any sugar in their food or drink. And how do they follow that? They use their discrimination, saying that this is not good for me, this I'm going to avoid. Then comes the role of the willpower. One has to use one's willpower to stick to the discrimination that they have made, right? And let's say this person's discrimination is perfect, this person's willpower is really good, and he abstains from all of these, sweets and sugars and whatever it is. But even for such a person, if you take a lump of sugar and put it in the tongue, won't the tongue find the sugar tasty and sweet? It will. The tongue does not lose the taste for the sugar. It is only through discrimination that person is avoiding it, right? So same is the case here. The taste will not go away so easily. Krishna will explain in the next few verses, you know, how it will vanish and what happens when it doesn't vanish. But before we move ahead, there are a few points that probably I would like to summarize from this verse, and then we can go ahead. One is very important, a theme which is recurrent in the Bhagavad Gita. Physical renunciation and austerity alone cannot make one a sthita prajna or a realized person. If we think that I can leave home and hearth, if I can leave my career and all of this and go sit in the forest and I will be able to become a jnani, it will not happen in that manner. Only renunciation, only austerity cannot make one a sthita prajna. Because one can run away from the world, but that does not guarantee that worldliness will be removed from within, right? So that leads to the next point, that constant vigilance is important in the spiritual path. I may have been living in the ashram for 20 years. I can say that I'm a student of Swami. I've had hundreds of darshans. I've had so many interviews. Swami has spoken to me so many times. Still, that does not remove the need for vigilance from my life. Still, I have to look at my mind. I have to see where the cravings are. What am I going after? What is the mind thinking about? So that vigilance is always very, very important. The next point is, this should not make me feel weak, but this should make me feel humble. If my mind gets filthy ideas and the mind goes after the sense objects after so many years of attempts, it should make me feel humble. It should not make me feel low esteem of self-hatred. And finally, as I mentioned, restraint does have its role. It does not mean that there is no need for restraint. In fact, that is the whole point of this thing, what Krishna is telling about sthita prajna and the verses which are going to follow. It all starts with restraint. So restraint is certainly important, and that should not be given up. Like the analogy that I mentioned of the mother and the child in the marketplace last week. When we do not let the actions follow the cravings of the senses and the mind, we are starving the senses, and the senses will be under control. Vishaya vinivartante niraharasya. When you do not feed the senses, they will start behaving properly, Krishna said in the previous verse. So the senses will come under control through the process of restraint and abstinence. So practicing sense control through simple living is important, but that alone will not guarantee wisdom. Just as we must be humble and cautious, we must also be confident and hopeful. And Krishna is going to tell how we can be confident and hopeful in the next verse. So we listen to verse number 61. I'll give you a short meaning after we listen to that, and then we'll discuss about that in detail.
Tani sarvani samyamya yukta asita mat Parah vashehi yasyendriyani tasya prajna pratishthita.
Controlling all of them, one should remain concentrated on me as the supreme. For the wisdom of one whose organs are under control becomes steadfast. So this is another verse that ends with tasya prajna pratishtita. such a person has wisdom that is steady and unmovable or immovable. So here Krishna speaks of the dual approach that is necessary, right? We had gone through this particular thing a couple of weeks ago. In fact, I had read out a passage from the Gita Vahini where Swami spoke that there is a two-pronged approach which is necessary. One is a positive approach and the other is a negative approach. And at that time I had said that what Swami speaks of as the positive approach will come later in the chapter. So this is the point it comes. Krishna says, Yukta, the one endowed with discrimination, Tani Sarvani Samyamya, should keep all under control, meaning the mind and the senses. And the second process is Asita Matparaha. Asita means to remain, to, it can be also said to be seated, but here it is to remain. Matparaha, devoted to me. In other words, Asita Matparaha can be described as one must be attached to me, right? Then he goes on to say, Vashehi Yasyendriyani. Vashe means to have under control. Vasha, I think even in other languages, in Indian languages, we use this word. Vasham means to have under one's control. Vashehi Yasyendriyani. Vashe, to keep under control. Yasyendriyani, one's senses. Tasya Prajna Pratishtita. That person's wisdom will be firmly established. So as Swami had explained, and in that particular passage that we had gone through from the Gita Vahini, there is a negative process and a positive process. The negative process is like weeding. There Swami had said, removing the desires from the mind through the process of discrimination. And the positive process that Swami had mentioned there is to develop attachment to God. So in this verse, Krishna has used the word, in the first verse that Krishna had used the phrase, Atmani eva atmana tushtaha. Krishna had used that as the positive approach. He said, Atmani eva atmana tushtaha, one who is satisfied in oneself. In this particular verse, he uses Asita Matparaha, being attached to me, as the positive. So this is a very beautiful way of saying that being turned inward and attached to the self is the same as being attached to God in devotion. Right? Because the same negative and positive approach is spoken of. The positive approach mentioned there was to be immersed in the self. The positive approach spoken of here is Asita Matparaha, to be attached to God. So both of this is same, right? That is a very beautiful way. Also, just like how when we find the source of bliss within, we will be more than satisfied, right? That is what we had discussed when we were going through that verse. And when we are satisfied in that manner, the taste for worldly pleasures will wither away. Similarly, when we develop this taste for God and God's love, when we relish the joy that is there in attachment to God, sensual pleasures will slowly start losing their grip over us. Swami would often give this beautiful analogy. He would say that initially when you all come to me, you are like houseflies, right? Swami would say the houseflies come and sit on all of these very tasty dishes that I've made. You know, you make all these sweet dishes like laddus and gulab jamuns and you put there. The houseflies will come and sit on them. Let's say the sweets are over or, you know, the shop is closed. The same houseflies will now go and sit on garbage. They'll go and sit on rotting food. So Swami would say, when you first come to me, you're like that. Yes, you relish being in my company. Yes, you relish, you know, when I come and talk to you, when you come and have my darshan, but you still have relish for the rotting substances of the world. So Swami would say, from being a housefly, eventually you should learn to become more like the honeybee. And what is the difference? Swami would say, the honeybee, even if it is starving, it will not go and sit on garbage. It always seeks its fulfillment only from honey, right? And so much so that Swami would say that it doesn't mind being trapped in the flower and giving up its life, as, you know, when the sun sets, the blossom starts closing up. Even then the honeybee is sitting there and drawing its nectar. So Swami would say that from being a housefly that definitely relishes God's company and thoughts of God and satsanga, but has not given up the relish for worldly pleasures, to a honeybee which finds relish only in, you know, being established in the self or being attached to God. That is why one practices refrain from sensual pleasures. Even as one is doing that, one must also develop the taste for higher bliss. And constantly, this conversation must go on in the mind, asking that, you know, do you really want to find fulfillment in this? When you have tasted Swami's, when you have tasted the joy of being with Swami, when you have tasted the joy of listening to the beautiful stories of Swami, do I still have to find relish in listening to this criticism of others? Or when these eyes have feasted upon Swami's form, does this eye still go after a sensual scene? Right? So this dialogue or this mananam has to be constantly going on inside. And this is very, very beautifully captured by the episode in the life of Saint Tyagaraja, right? Where the king sends him royal gifts and invites him to the palace to perform in front of him. So Saint Tyagaraja writes a beautiful song, which is nothing but a conversation that he has within. He says, Nidichala Sukhama, Ramuni Sannidhi Seva Sukhama, Nijamuga Paluku Manasa. He says, Nidichala Sukhama, do you think that there is happiness in this worldly wealth which is in front of you? Or Ramuni Sannidhi Seva Sukhama, or do you find happiness in the service to your Rama's feet? And he is asking this question to his own mind. He says, oh mind, you tell me the truth. Right? So this kind of a conversation, Swami says, should constantly go on. In fact, in the next verse, he says, Dadi Navanita Kshira Mulu Rucho, Dasharati Dhyana Bhajana Sudha Rasamu Rucho. He says, is milk, butter and curd tasty, or the nectarine experience of meditation and worship of Rama more delectable? Nijamuga paluku manasa, O mind, you tell me the truth. So he is asking himself, you have tasted the joy of being lost in meditation of the Lord's feet. You have also tasted milk, you have also tasted butter and all of these things which give taste to the tongue. You tell me which have you found sweeter. I think any of us who have really felt the joy of singing Swami's bhajans and being lost in Swami will know that there is no comparison at all. Yes, we still go after all the tasty things which give relish to the tongue. But if we were to pause and ask this question, I think the mind itself will give the answer that there is no comparison. You know, it is Dasharati Dhyana Bhajana Sudhara Samu. It is in the joy of getting lost in meditation of the Lord. Then the next line is very beautiful. I think it is perfectly placed in the discussion that we are having. He says, Dama Shama Manu Ganga Snanamu Sukhama, Kardama Durvishaya Kupa Snanamu Sukhama. Dama and Shama is mind and sense control, right? So the act of having control over oneself, Tyagaraja says, is like taking a dip in the Ganges. Dama Shama Muna Ganga Snanamu Sukhama. So he says, it is like taking a dip in the Ganges. You tell me, do you find more happiness in that? Or then he says, Kardama Durvishaya Kupa Snanamu Sukhama. He says, the bad things that attract you, it is like taking a dip in a sewer. It is like taking a dip in a slush. What gives you more happiness? Does taking a dip in the Ganges which cleanses you, or taking a dip in this slush which is a dip only for namesake, because it does not clean you, it makes you dirtier? And that's a very, very beautiful expression that he uses, because in the next verse that we are going to go through, Krishna is going to explain that indulgence does not satisfy. Indulgence only increases the craving. So when you're trying to clean yourself, why will you take a dip in a place which makes you dirtier? So he says, Dama Shamamuna Ganga Snanamu Sukhama, Kardama Durvishaya Kupa Snanamu Sukhama. O mind, do you find relish in taking a dip in these worldly things? So such mananam or such contemplation should constantly keep going on. Again, in the later part of the second chapter, Krishna will explain the importance of this contemplation and the importance of constantly having this dialogue in the mind. Right? So Krishna says, when one has already started making the efforts in this direction, one knows to discriminate. but it is important to constantly stop and question oneself. The next couple of verses, 62 and 63, actually they should be played together, but I think we'll take only 62 because I'd like to explain that a little bit in detail. It's a very important verse. It's an oft-quoted verse, and it is an explanation of the human psyche. It's very, very well described in this verse and the next one. We'll listen to this next verse, verse number 62, in Brother Shyam's voice. I'll give you a short meaning after that, and then we'll discuss it in detail.
Dhyayato vishayan pumsaha sangasteshu pajayate sangat sanjayate kamaha kamat krodho bhijayate.
When a man dwells on the objects of sense, he creates an attraction for them. Attraction develops into desire, and desire breeds anger. Swami says in the Gita Vaini, and I think this has to be kept in mind, whatever explanation that we've been going through depends on this, and whatever we are going to go through also depends on this. So I'll quote those two lines. Swami says, people have three chief instruments: the mind, the intellect, and the senses. It is when these three work in unison and cooperate with one another that either immersion in the flux or samsara or liberation in the knowledge of the Atma is realized. End of quote. So I'll repeat that again because it's a very important description. Swami says, people have three chief instruments: the mind, the intellect, and the senses. It is when these three work in unison and cooperate with one another that either immersion in the flux or liberation in the knowledge of the Atma is realized. So to be lost or to reach the goal, to be bound or to become free, these three, the mind, the intellect, and the senses, have to work in tandem. The senses always, as we've been going through in the past few weeks, drags us outward, right? And when we say it drags us, it drags the mind outward. The mind as such has no physical nature of its own, right? Even if it is being dragged by the senses, the mind as such cannot do anything other than think about it, other than contemplate on that which is attracting it. But the real indulgence of the mind happens through actions, right? That is why when Swami explained to that student, Swami said, see, your senses are dragging the mind outward, but you ensure that your actions do not follow the mind, right? So that is the nature of the senses in the mind, but our discrimination when it says that this is wrong, of course, when it says that the mind going after the senses is wrong, that is when we start feeling guilty. But as Swami was saying, that your intellect, your discrimination is saying that it is wrong, so ensure that you do not follow the mind. And this is again a very, very important thing. I have mentioned this many, many times as part of the answering booth. Swami would never allow us to label ourselves as sinners or people who have, you know, people of bad thoughts or people of bad, because the moment we label ourselves, we are giving ourselves the license to live our lives like that. So Swami would say that, you know, your mind is going after these things, your intellect is saying that it is wrong. Instead of saying, oh my God, you know, my mind is dirty and I am a bad person, use your discrimination to say that the mind is going after the wrong things, I will not follow it with actions. So when we label ourselves as a bad person because my mind is bad, we tend to give ourselves that license to be a bad person, right? If I could put it that way. But when we do not follow the mind, as Swami very beautifully said, just ensure that your discrimination stops your actions and words from following the mind, right? So using the intellect, I think we must ensure that the actions don't follow the senses and the mind. But what happens when we don't do this? That is what this particular verse and the next verse, which we'll go through, speaks about. Krishna says, Dhyayato vishayan pumsaha. Pumsa means man, dhyayato vishayan. When a man contemplates on the objects of the senses, sangaha, attachment, teshu upajayate, attachment arises in that person. So Krishna says, dhyayate vishayan pumsaha. When a man contemplates on the objects of the senses, sangaha teshu upajayate, attachment arises in that person. As we had discussed even last week, we may not be able to indulge in a craving of the senses due to various reasons. It's not necessary that I'm a wise person and so I'm not indulging. It's not necessary that, I'm a very spiritual person and I'm not indulging. It could even be that I'm not able to afford it. Or it may be that I'm abstaining because of social compulsions and pressures from around. So there are many reasons because of which we are not able to necessarily follow the cravings of the mind. Or we may be in a state where we are able to follow the cravings with actions. Whether we follow the actions, follow with actions the cravings, or we have the cravings and we can't afford to follow it, sometimes the result of both of these are quite equal. Even if it is only mental indulgence when we're not able to afford to follow the cravings, right? The discrimination must step in and say, I don't want this thing, this is not worth craving for, so I will not keep thinking about it. If this doesn't happen, the mind will indulge by continuing to contemplate on it, even if it is not able to follow it with actions, right? And when that happens, Krishna says it leads to attachment. That contemplation of the mind on the cravings will lead to attachment. Because whether I crave for something and don't have it, or crave for something and have it, I will become dependent on that particular object or thing or person for me to be happy. It's again something which we've been repeating over and over again. The moment you get attached to something, you are putting your control outside of you, which means it will lead to attachment. Sangaha upajayate. Now, this statement is also an indication of how we develop passions, right? Well, each one of us are passionate about different things. We all are different in our own way in that sense. Someone is passionate about becoming a very successful businessman. Someone is passionate about becoming famous. Someone is passionate about doing a lot of philanthropic work, maybe. Or somebody might be passionate about one particular person. What makes us different from each other is that we have different ambitions and goals. Right? That is the basic difference between each one of us. Otherwise, we all would be very, very similar. So the answer is in dhyayato vishayan pumsah sangasteshu jayate. Sangasteshu upajayate. I'm sorry. What we dwell upon, contemplate constantly, not just in this one lifetime, but in any number of lifetimes, that becomes our attachments. And many times, there are so many unfulfilled ambitions, right? So these are the things which we have developed a fantasy for. And this does not happen only in one lifetime. What I am today, you find this even in children who are just growing up, that one child craves for different things from the other. Where does this difference comes from? These are all unfulfilled cravings which have not been fulfilled, which have not been removed through discrimination, which have eventually become attachments, which have eventually become a part of a personality which starts showing up, right? So these are the things which we have developed a fantasy for. We think that if I have this, my life will be so much better, right? But when that has not happened, it becomes a craving and that becomes an attachment which becomes a part of my personality. So many times you would see that when we are after something, that deprivation increases that craving. That is why I said, if there is a craving, whether the senses follow it, whether the actions follow it, or the actions are not able to follow it because of some reason, the craving's effect on the mind is pretty similar. Talking about the Mahabharata itself, the character of Karna was like that. he constantly was craving for the status of a warrior. He wanted the society to look at him as a great warrior, as a kshatriya. And of course, because of him being brought up by a charioteer, he never gets that status. So constantly he's craving for that. And when we say he's craving for that, there is this sense in the mind that if I have this, I would have had everything, or I would have something which will give me happiness, right? But he is constantly craving for that. He does not get that. Eventually, you know, Duryodhana steps in. He makes him a king. But even after becoming a king, he does not find satisfaction. The reason why he does not find satisfaction is satisfaction does not come from anything outside. But in his mind, he thinks that maybe if I defeat Arjuna in a battle, then the society will look at me as a great warrior. So he is constantly striving for something more and more. The craving never seems to be satisfied, right? This is what developing fantasy for anything does. How do we develop this fantasy? It all starts with the senses, right? So that is why abstinence of senses is something Krishna keeps repeating. Let's say we see someone living in a big house with a pool, right? That's how it starts. It starts with the senses giving a certain input. So we see someone living in a luxurious house like this, or we read about it in a magazine, or someone comes and tells us, you know, hey, did you know that so-and-so is living in such a palatial house? Then the mind starts imagining, oh, how happy I would be if I were to live in a family, in a house like that. How happy I would be if my family and children are able to live in a house with all those facilities. So it is an imagination. It is a fantasy that if I have that, I will find happiness, right? Then that thought gets stuck in the mind. So after that, you know, let's say you go home, and constantly every stimuli which happens around you will remind you of, oh, how good it would be if I had that big house. Some problem in the house, some repair in the house, you'll say, oh, how nice it would be if I was in that particular house with all of these facilities. You have guests at home, there's no place in the house, you'll think, oh, how nice it would be if I had the bigger house. There would have been more rooms in that, and, you know, we would have been more comfortable, right? And this is what Krishna has referred to, dhyayate. Your mind begins to contemplate on something that you've started fantasizing about, even without your own volition. It is not like you are thinking about the house, but once you have fantasized that, once you have got this idea that if I have this thing, I will be happy, it starts repeating in your mind over and over again. It keeps coming up again and again, right? So that is what Krishna says, dhyayate, you end up contemplating about it even without your knowledge. And such preoccupation with the thoughts of the vishaya, or the object of the senses, leads to attachment or sangaha. Because you will start striving for it, right? The best way of describing attachment, as we saw last week, something which becomes sticky, we are not able to get over it. We have got obsessed with this idea that I will be happy only if I obtain it, or something which you already have, you hold tight to it, saying that if I let go of this, I will not be happy. That stickiness, as we saw last week, that is what is attachment. And that comes because of these kind of cravings, as Krishna says here. Now, as we go through life, we have many, many fantasies, right? It is not like one or two that we can count. And I think any person with common sense will know that not all fantasies can be pursued in one lifetime. In fact, most of us make many of these choices even while we are children studying, right? We choose between academics and sports, or we choose between music and academics, or we choose between two sports. Now, some people who are very good at multiple sports, they say that, okay, which one should I take up as a career? So we know that all fantasies and all imaginations that we have cannot be pursued. So we begin to choose what we want to pursue. So when we make the choice, we start pursuing it, which means we start making efforts in that direction of receiving that or attaining something. In other words, I start doing actions driven by the thought that I should achieve this. This is what is referred to as desire, right? We are having a desire, and that desire is leading us to make some particular thought. We refer to as kamya karma, or actions that are done with a desire to achieve something. Of course, this phrase kamya karma is specifically used for certain sacrifices and ritual practices which are done to achieve something, right? There is again something which Krishna had referred to in the verses in the second chapter, where he said that you look at the Vedas as a process to achieve something in life or beyond this life. So Kamya Karma is usually referred to such rituals, but the meaning of that phrase is applicable to this. When you start pursuing something, saying that if I have this, I'll be happy, so I'm going to make efforts to get this, then you start doing Kamya Karma, right? And Krishna says, Sangat Samjayate Kamaha. Through that attachment, eventually it leads to Kama or desires. So this whole process happens not necessarily in one lifetime, but many, many lifetimes. It's quite complicated in the sense that there are some deep yearnings within us, there are some fleeting cravings within us which go through our mind even as we are living this life, and there are some things which we are deeply already pursuing, right? So we are in the middle of all of this, and what Krishna is explaining here as a method, sense control, discrimination, that constant contemplation of what is worth pursuing, and this constant input of what is right and what is wrong and what is truth and what is untruth, all of this works for whichever stage we are in, whether we are having fleeting cravings or we are having some unfulfilled desires or we are in the middle of pursuing a desire. Whatever is the stage, for all of these, the points which Krishna is giving works. So this whole process happens through many, many lifetimes, and we are in the middle of that. Some fantasies we follow, some we don't. Those that we don't follow, we may carry in our mind and it may manifest in a different lifetime. Those that we follow and realize that there is no joy in them, and those cravings go away, right? There are many cravings like that. Within our lifetime, we can say that we fancy something and then eventually we have it and then we let go of it. There are a lot of rich people who have lost their, who get disillusioned about money, right? Because they find that they've worked so hard and they've earned so much money, but they've lost so many other joys of life. Similarly, somebody who must have craved for something, they have it and then they find that, oh, I thought this would be much more better than this, but this is not as good. So many such cravings go away, but there are some other cravings also which do not go away so easily. Let's say that I have a craving for power. You know, I'm a CEO of a company and I've gone through the ranks because I've always wanted more power and more authority. Eventually, I become a CEO. I become a CEO, then I find that the local MLA seems to be having more power than me. He's obstructing the plans that I have for my company. So let's say I stand in the election and become an MLA. And I find that being an MLA is also not good enough, because being a minister in the cabinet is more is better than being an MLA, or whatever is the sequence. So the craving for such things, not all cravings go away by we going through them. Some cravings pull us into that, it's like a quicksand. It keeps pulling us further and further. That is why, whether it is a craving that gets, you know, which can be used away by going through it, or a craving that does not go away in that manner, the best way is to always use discrimination. Even as we are going through that experience, go through that process of discrimination. Is it really giving me the happiness that I sought? This power which I thought is going to give me peace of mind, it doesn't seem to be giving me. It gives me more headache. So that discrimination, that honest contemplation should always go on. That is what will help us get over any kind of craving, whether it is a deep craving or a fleeting craving. Slowly, in that manner, the desire itself will be dismantled over a period of time. But if we don't do that, if we blindly follow the desires, however successful we are, we cannot fulfill all our desires. Just like how we cannot follow all our cravings, even the cravings that we follow, we cannot necessarily fulfill all our desires. Someone who is more successful, you'll always feel that I could have done more, I could have achieved more, right? And if the desire is not dismantled, that will eventually lead to some form of frustration, because all desires cannot be fulfilled. And that's what Krishna says, Kamat Krodha Abhijayati. from desires, anger arises. When we have a desire, when we are trying to pursue it, when we are putting all our actions in that pursuit of that desire, when our pursuit is obstructed by any means, by a person, by circumstances, we start getting agitated. We get angry with the person who is obstructing us. We probably get angry with ourselves because of our weaknesses, or like most of us, we get angry with Swami. We get angry with God. I have a desire and I'm not able to achieve it. So that's why Krishna says, Kamat krodha abhijayati. From desires, anger comes. We tend to become agitated when the desires are not fulfilled. So the root cause for all of this, as Krishna has been saying, is the senses. And as Swami said, the senses, the mind and the intellect. The usage of these three is the most critical aspect of human life. And that is what he explained in this particular verse. I'll probably give that meaning of that verse once again. Dhyayate, dhyayato vishayan pumsaha. When a man dwells on objects of the senses, contemplates constantly, when something becomes a craving, when something becomes a fantasy, it starts occupying more of your mind space. This is something which I always tend to think. What occupies our mind space is something that we have to constantly look at. Is it worth worrying about? Is it worth feeling sorry about this? Is it worth craving for this? You know, I don't have this money, but do I need to constantly think about this money? So-and-so is troubling me. Do I need to give mind space to that person? So it is very important to make that call. When we talk about sense control, mind control, that is what it finally comes to. To stop the running mind and say that, no, I don't want to indulge more in this through thoughts. So he says, dhyayate vishayan pumsaha. But when you don't do that and when you start letting your mind to contemplate on something that you have placed your mind on, he says, sangasteshu upajayate. That will lead to attachment. When you allow your mind to contemplate endlessly on something, and sangat samjayate kamaha, that attachment will lead to further desire. As Swami would say, desire, we tend to think that, oh, I have 10 desires, and if I fulfill these 10 desires, I'm going to be happy. Swami would say, fulfilling desires is like, itching yourself when you have eczema. That's the most graphic example that Swami uses. Because when you itch yourself when you have that itching sensation, Swami says the itching does not reduce, it only increases. In that manner, when you're attached to a few things, when you start pursuing them, it only leads to an increase of desires. Sangat samjayate kamaha, kamat krodho abhijayate. He says, when you have desires, definitely desires will... There will be desires which will not be fulfilled. There will be desires which will take time to be fulfilled, right? Not all desires, the moment you have it, the next day it's going to be fulfilled. So all of this will lead to krodha or anger or agitation, right? And the verse that comes next, which we'll go through next week, verse number 63, Krishna takes this further. And in fact, the verses which are going to follow, 64 and 65, the entire way in which the mind gets muddled up, and this has not happened, as I said, in a lifetime. It has happened over many, many lifetimes. But it is never late to take control of the situation. And that is why we go through verses like the Bhagavad Gita. We go through books like the Bhagavad Gita. We go through lectures, discourses. We listen to Swami, the satsanga, the talks. All of that is so that at least now we can take control of the mind. At least now we can lead a conscious life, a discriminating life, saying that this is my goal and these things don't add up to that goal, don't help me to pursue that goal. And that is what the whole effort is, right? Whether me doing this program or you listening to this program, that is the whole effort. So with that prayer to Swami, that Swami, with your guidance, as Swami very beautifully, Krishna very beautifully said, with that sense control, with that discrimination, you must have attachment to me. So, Swami, we pray for that. We pray for that discrimination. We pray for that sense control. And we pray that that deep love and attachment for Swami and Swami's feet arises in all of us. With that prayer, dear listeners, I offer this effort at Swami's lotus feet. I'll meet you all again next week at 7:30 p.m. for resuming this Triune Pilgrimage of the Gita series. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu for the last segment of today, the Vahini Satsang. I'll meet you all next week. Till then, take care. Jai Sai Ram.